send someone money electronically? Is it worth it to buy an extended warranty for your vehicle? Where are the best places to retire? We will get answers to these questions and yours on this edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. If you have a personal finance question to run by financial planner Kevin McKinley, call 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, and he joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Joy.
So a couple of studies are out that can help retirees decide where the best place is to spend their retirement years. I'm pretty interested in what these studies have to say, Kevin.
Yes, in honor of your long and distinguished career at Wisconsin Public Radio, but your looming retirement, we are going to be discussing issues facing retirees now and for the next couple of weeks. One survey from GoBankingRates.com looked at where would $1 million last the longest. So if you were fortunate enough to retire and have $1 million, which states would allow you to hang on to that money for as long as possible? And what they did is they looked at what those who are over 65 spend and then compared the cost of those expenditures between the different states. And the best states, this is where your money would go farthest as a retiree. Mississippi was number one, Arkansas number two, and Oklahoma number three. The worst at number 50 was Alaska, and then 49 was California, and 48 was Hawaii. And in our geographic listening area, Wisconsin was 23rd, Minnesota 28th, Iowa 13th, and Illinois was 25th.
Darn, Hawaii costs a lot of money.
Yeah, surprising, wasn't it?
But cost can't be the only factor to consider. What else did these studies look at?
Bankrate.com did another survey similar, except they didn't weigh cost in as the only factor. They weighed other things such as the quality of life, like healthcare, crime, cultural and social activities, the weather, and then taxes at the tail end. And they found that New Hampshire, Colorado, and Maine were the best places to go, and the worst were Arkansas, West Virginia, and Alabama. And we did a little better in the Midwest. Wisconsin was 9th in this study, Minnesota 5th, Iowa 4th, and Illinois 34th.
Mm-hmm. Are there any wide disparities between the two studies?
Yeah, we covered a lot of states in there, and you can see the way that especially our states came out, that there is a difference. So what we did is we combined the two studies and ranked them both. And number three is Michigan, number two was Idaho, and the number one place, based on these combined studies, for retirees, Wisconsinites, you need to head to the southwest, to the warm, sunny climate of Iowa.
Seriously?
The number one best state of combining the studies, the worst ones were Alaska, Hawaii, Maryland, and New York. In our area, Wisconsin, Minnesota all scored in the upper 50%. Iowa was obviously the best, and Illinois was in the bottom 50%.
Well, you know what? I'm still a Wisconsin lifer.
You will be, whether you want to be or not, yeah. Even when you leave.
That's right. So what is the best way to scout out retirement to another state?
This should be part of the fun of retirement, is thinking about if you are going to move and if you are going to move where. But don't act too rashly. Start out by picking a few of these spots and just get a hotel room or Airbnb for a few days. And if you like that, you maybe want to come back in a little while and get something on VRBO that is something that is going to mimic your actual living experience, like a condo. And stay there for a week or two. Hopefully you can drive so you can have your car there and scout the area and see what you like. And if you really like it, then you might want to think about renting an apartment or a condo for a year. It's much better to rent first before you buy. And then and only then if you decide, no, this is really the right place for us. We have ties to the area. It's a unique property that we can't duplicate by renting year to year. Then and only then is it a good idea to think about actually buying a house or a condo.
Well, I know I'll be using all of those venues that you mentioned to look for vacations to take away from the Wisconsin winter every once in a while. But I think for the most part, Wisconsin is stuck with me. That's the way it is.
Good.
Yeah. Kevin McKinley, managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. That being said, if you have a question for Kevin, you can call 1-800-642-1234. We have an open line for you, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. We do have Diane in Emerald with us. Hi, Diane.
Hi. I have a question about some employee stock that I have from a company that I used to work for. And in 2008, it had plummeted in the value, but now the value is back up. Actually, it's even higher. So I don't know if and I'm 60 years old, so I do not know if I should keep it in there or I should take it out. And I can only get fifths of that when I take it out. So I'll get, for 5 years, I'll get that money.
Okay, so you can only take 20% of the stock value out each year until you've exhausted. That's the most you can cash out, right?
Correct, yes.
Okay, Diane.
I could also sell it back to them and then, you know, that common stock,
right.
I guess.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm surprised, Diane. When did you leave the company?
In 2008.
Okay, well, it's then I'm guessing your departure was the reason the stock declined so precipitously right afterwards, right?
Oh, correct.
Okay, is it a significant amount of money, Diane, to you? And by significant, I mean if it were to go to zero, would you be in much worse shape financially, or is it not that big of a deal relative to the rest of your financial picture?
Oh, it's a good amount.
Okay.
And I definitely would need it.
Yeah, definitely. If I were you, without knowing the stock and without knowing your situation, I would tell you that you should be slowly selling it, because if it's a significant amount of money, you have a lot of your financial security tied up into a company over which you really have no knowledge of what they're going to do in the future. You don't have a lot of control over it. And if it would bother you, if the stock would decline a lot, I would sell it. And especially with those parameters that you mentioned, where you can only sell a certain portion every single year, you know, if you really need that money for something, as you mentioned, it's going to take you 5 years to get the proceeds for it. So I would start on a measured plan of selling up to 20% each year, and until you get the money back out of it. And then at that point, after 2 or 3 years, if you say, you know, I'm just going to keep this now, I've got some of the cash out of it. If the stock continues to do well, great. If it doesn't, then I've at least pulled some cash out of it. But no, offhand and based on the information you've provided, I'd recommend you consider selling it.
Good luck to you, Diane. Thank you for calling. A listener emailed, Tom says, here's my shameless praise. Love your radio show on Tuesday mornings on WPR. Well, I guess that's pretty shameless.
He goes on to, it's not, hopefully not false, but definitely shameless.
Yes, right. He goes on to say that his daughter is in college in another town, and he was trying to send her some money electronically via a service called Pop Money. I like that name, Pop Money. He wondered if you knew if this is secure or if there was a better alternative. What do you think, Kevin?
Well, Pop Money allows anyone to send funds to anyone else. You can send it from one person's bank account to another if they both have the Pop Money service, or you can just send it via email or text. And how it actually works is the person, if they don't have an account tied to the Pop Money service, they get a notification either via email or text that says, hey, someone's trying to send you money, and you got to log on to Pop Money, and you got to enter in the data, your bank account data, of where that money is supposed to go. It's usually a small fee to do so. It's about a dollar or so at the most. And again, even if you don't have an account that uses that, you can send and receive money as well. And if you get a notification as well, same thing.
Is Pop Money some kind of fly-by-night operation?
You know, you would think so by the name, but no, absolutely not. It's a division of Fiserv, a company based in Brookfield, Wisconsin. And Brookfield and the Fiserv, rather, is a very large provider of back-end software and electronic services to tons of banks and credit unions. They claim to serve 2,400 institutions and have 70 million online customers. The problem, though, that Pop Money name is fun for people who are young or, like you, young at heart. But those of us who are old get a little concerned about using a service like that when it's not First National Trust something, something, you know, fealty, guarantee, a lot of names like that. So, and because those of us who are old generally are the ones who have the money, they might run into a little issue until this generation ages into prosperity.
Well, what made me laugh is that this was a pop sending his daughter money.
Yeah, I didn't even, geez, I'm sorry. I didn't even think of that. That's very good, Joy. Yeah. Joy, you're just hitting your stride here and then you're leaving.
But so I don't have to worry at all about using Pop Money?
No, not at all. The timing might be a little issue. Some of the complaints online of the people who have looked at these services have said that it might take a few days longer than you would want it to make sure that the money clears for it. And if that's the case, you want it to happen more quickly, you might look at a service like Venmo, Square Cash, Google Wallet. Some of these services, actually, you can just transfer money from a debit card to another debit card. Where I think the biggest potential for concern with these services is not with the services themselves or the security, but it's actually with fraudsters contacting you and saying, hey, someone wants to send you money from XYZ money transfer service. Click on this link and then give us all of your bank account information so that we can put this money in your account. And of course, most people are going to say, oh, great, I'm not going to question this. Someone's trying to send me money. So if you do get a notice like this, contact the sender first and say, who are you and why are you sending me money? And rather than logging in on the links that the people provide for it, Google the site itself and go to the site and click on it and then log in. And that's a way to make sure that you're not handing over all of your data to nefarious parties.
If you have a question for Kevin, you can email it to onyourmoney@wpr.org. It may be answered on this show or a future show. You can also call 1-800-642-1234. Therese in Waterloo has a question. Hi, Therese.
Hi. I don't have a question so much as a comment. I've lived in five different states, and this is the method that I use when I'm thinking about moving to a different area, is I get the Sunday newspaper delivered to me for about 6 months. And it's a real cheap way of finding out what's important to that community, what are the prices like, what are the services that are around, and you get a real flavor for everything at a real cheap price.
Oh, great. And what made you choose Waterloo?
Actually, I work in Waterloo.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so I guess that's a big, important part of it, too.
It's very good. Yeah, Teresa, first of all, this is interesting because apparently we let comments through without false praise. So I appreciate that. That's a new policy we're developing here. And, Teresa, just out of curiosity, was someone chasing you from state to state? Okay, good.
You know, I just had different opportunities, and I came back to the Midwest. I'm from South Dakota originally, so I could raise my daughter in the Midwest, and it's been a real good fit for us. But, you know, there were other opportunities that came along. I worked in the aerospace industry for a while, and that was kind of a bloodbath in certain times. So I was looking at relocating, and some of the cities that I got the newspapers from went by the wayside because I decided it wasn't a fit for my family.
Yeah. Didn't like what you saw, and I'll say something again. This will reveal me as being older than what one might believe, but I, as much as I love to gather news and information online, there's still something you can get from a tactile newspaper page that you can't get online. And I think that's even more so about the community. And you mentioned about the Sunday paper. Well, having those flyers in there, you get a better idea what stores are in the area and which ones are vibrant and active. And no, Therese, I think it's a great idea and I appreciate the comment.
Yes, thanks very much, Therese. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. If you have a question, 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine, along with financial planner Kevin McKinley, answering your personal finance questions. If you have one, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kathy in Fond du Lac is with us now. Hi, Kathy. Hello, Kathy, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, hello. There you are. Go ahead.
I'm reaching 59 and a half this year, and thinking of pulling out an amount of money from my 401k to take a couple of bucket list trips before I get too old to enjoy them. And I'm just wondering if there are any issues about amount that I can pull out, or rules that wouldn't enable me to do that.
No, there's no issues in. You just want to try to do it in a way that the taxes are as low as possible. Kathy, is this a 401k at the job you currently work at, or is it one from a prior employer?
Well, I have a 401k where I currently work, and I have a small amount in a 403b from a previous job.
Okay, so the 403b is the one you're considering drawing from?
I probably would empty that out.
Okay, that sounds good. No, and I think that that's a good idea, and especially if it's something that, is it a trip you're looking to take, Kathy?
It is. I actually have a trip to Hawaii and a trip to Europe that I've wanted for years, and this seems like the good time to do it.
Oh, why would you spend your money that way when you could spend it on nursing home expenses in 30 years? That sounds terrible.
I've worked in nursing homes for 35 years. I don't want to go live there.
Oh, then you deserve this trip way more than anyone else, Kathy. So good for you. I'm very glad to hear that. And yes, one of the rules of thumb for our On Your Money retirees is that you can typically... if you want to know how much money can you typically spend, is to take your amount of savings that you have and divide it by the months you expect to live, and that's how much you can spend for a typical month. And that, of course, doesn't include any Social Security or pension payments you might be expecting. So if you run those numbers and you say, I have X amount of dollars, let's say you have $100,000 and you expect to live for 100 months, you can spend $1,000 per month. So as long as you're spending within that budget, or after you clean out this 403B, you'll still have enough to meet those goals. No, I think it's a very good idea. And when people report over their lives where they receive the most satisfaction from spending money, trips always come out on top. Stuff really falls towards the bottom. Trips come out on top. So again, I definitely think you should do this. And I think you should do it sooner rather than later, because to take these kinds of trips, it's not climbing Mount Everest, but still you have to be able to walk around and see everything and get on and off the plane and sit through the flights and everything. And at a certain age, we might be alive, but we might be less able to withstand the rigors of that kind of travel. And so if you can afford it, I definitely recommend you take the trips, tap the accounts, and just pay the taxes on it and be done with it.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Have a great time, Kathy. I'm jealous, but I'm going to be hopefully doing a very similar thing when I retire.
Are you going to do nothing but just lead those trips, the bus trips and everything to Branson?
That's what I should do. That should be my encore career.
People would love to go with you if you sat in the front of the bus with your handheld microphone.
Ladies and gentlemen, go to Branson. That's funny. But that's going to be something I'm going to look into, Kevin. That might be fun. But no, my next trip, I think, is going to be the Galapagos Islands.
Ooh.
I have always wanted to go there. And Machu Picchu in Peru, another one. And that's just it. That is something you do need, the ability to walk up
and down those big steps. Right.
So anyway, looking forward to those trips. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money. Our number is 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Sarah in Oconomowoc is next. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. I have a $20,000 CD that matured last week. So I'm wondering which would be a better choice, putting it into a one-year CD at 1.90, expecting interest rates will rise, or putting it into a five-year CD for 2.35%.
Sarah, that's a good question. I'm going to ask you one that I bet you don't know the answer to. What is the surrender penalty if you pull that five-year CD out early?
Well, I don't know.
Okay. That's okay. Most people don't. That's what I would use to determine which one to go with because, you know, we've been waiting for interest rates to rise for about 9 years now, and they've risen a little bit in the last 6 to 8 months. They may continue to rise somewhat in the future, but one of the things a lot of people are forgetting is that if interest rates rise a lot, that would be good for people who are saving money and renewing CDs, but it would be very bad for a lot of other spots in the economy, and quite frankly, it would be bad for a country that owes trillions of dollars in debt to itself and lots of other investors. And so I wouldn't expect interest rates to rise substantially. I'd prefer that you take out the longer rate CD, check the penalty for early withdrawal. If it's 6 months or maybe 12 months, that's pretty reasonable. And so if interest rates rise, great. You can pull that out early if you want and take advantage of a higher rate CD someplace else or some other kind of investment. But if interest rates stay the same or worse yet fall, you'd be very glad you locked in that 2.35% for the 5 year.
Thank you very much. Good answer.
Good answer, Kevin. It was good. Sarah, thanks for the call. Good luck. Tony in Whitewater is with us. Hi, Tony.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Hey, I was just wondering if we're looking at these micro-investing apps, and we chose one called Acorn. And I was wondering if it's something where every time we make a purchase, it rounds up our purchase and then invests that money. On a smaller scale, turns out to be about $30 or $40 a month for what we're doing. Is it better off to take that money and invest it in some of the other things that we've been doing, or is it? I don't know. I just wanted to get your take on what those micro investing apps and tools are, and see if it's worth it for us.
Well, worth it in the sense, is it going to make a huge deal? Probably not. But in the sense, and in and of itself, is it a good service? If it gets you to save money that you would otherwise not save, yes, it's a good service. And especially if it can be done at a relatively low cost. Usually when people see the, you know, $2 or $3 a month or $2 or $3 a year or whatever, they don't realize that that's eating up a substantial percentage of the small dollars that they have in there, and therefore any potential return is probably going to go just for the fees. There's really not much of an extra service on that, although some people have used these and said, look, it's anything that gets me to save money, I'm glad to have it, even if I don't make any money on that money. So I think they're great. I'd prefer that you have larger dollar amounts also set aside, whether it's in an at-work retirement plan or maybe every single month into a Roth IRA, a few hundred dollars a month if you can afford it. But there's certainly nothing wrong with these services.
Okay. They just seem like a lot of fun just to stick some money in there and watch it grow, basically.
When it grows, it's fun. The problem, Tony, is when it doesn't grow, it's surprisingly not as much fun.
Absolutely.
All right. Thanks, Tony, very much for the call. And it is time now for Smart Assets. We've discussed the benefits of pre-tax versus Roth retirement plan contributions. And a new study says that the Roths may win out in the end. What's this all about, Kevin?
Well, it's not for the reasons you might imagine. As a refresher, and you know, if you put money into a regular 401k or a 403b, the money goes in pre-tax, meaning whatever you put in there is not taxed as ordinary income. So if you make $50,000 a year, you put $10,000 into the 401k, you're only taxed like you made $40,000. Of course, when you pull that money out in retirement, it will be taxable as ordinary income. A Roth 401k or 403b is the exact opposite. You don't get any tax breaks when you put money into it. But ostensibly, when you pull the money out in retirement, it's tax-free.
So what has your stance been on the issue?
It all boils down to what your tax bracket is now versus what it will be in retirement. And for most people, they're in a higher tax bracket while they're working than they are when they're retiring, in part because, you know, when we retire, we usually have lower income, but also because we can manipulate our income stream in retirement. It's something we can't do while we're working. And so if one of the best ways you can enhance your retirement income is to watch where you pull the money from and when you take it out, because you can reduce your taxes quite substantially in some cases by manipulating that way. Therefore, tax brackets in retirement are more likely to be lower, and therefore my contention is that you're better off using the pre-tax plan. But some new research that just came out may counter that belief.
What does that research say?
There was a Harvard associate professor who said, we tracked how people use these various accounts, say a 401k and a Roth 401k. And what we found is that people, when we say, how much do you save in this? They say, well, we try to save 10% of our income, or we try to save $5,000 a year. And he found that because the Roth users actually have a bigger tax bill that they pay when April 15th rolls around, because remember, they did not get a tax break on their deposits, they actually end up saving more money. They save the, let's say, $5,000 a year, plus they pay the taxes on it, whereas people who use the pre-tax plan only save the $5,000 a year, and they are less likely to save and then invest the tax savings that the pre-tax or 401k or 403b provides.
Did that study change your mind at all?
No, nothing changes my mind, no matter what information I get. No, I still think they should use the pre-tax plan at work, save at least enough to get any employer match. If you have more money, save enough to get below the 15% federal income tax bracket. And then if you have even more money, max out that baby and get at least the max for under 50 is $18,000 and $24,000 for those over 50. Then if you have money above and beyond what you can hit to those thresholds, put that into a Roth IRA, because that can serve as a savings account, because you can pull the contributions to a Roth IRA out at any time for any reason with no taxes or penalties whatsoever. And best of all, what you really should do is check out your tax savings that you get by putting the money into a pre-tax retirement plan and then use that to make the Roth IRA contribution.
Kevin McKinley is a financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, and this is On Your Money. Coming up on this edition of On Your Money, we will find out if it's worth it to buy an extended warranty for our vehicles, and Kevin will answer more of your questions. If you have a personal finance question for Kevin, we again have an open line for you at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. We have Ed in Crandon with us. Hi, Ed.
Good morning.
Morning.
False praise first.
Good, thank you.
And second, last week I just caught a little bit. I'm 68 and I've not drawn Social Security yet. And, you know, I know about this 8% or whatever it figures out to be. And you had mentioned something that last week in passing that actually ends up only being 3 or 4% in real terms. Was I hearing that correctly?
You heard that correctly, and everything I mentioned on this show is just in passing, Ed. What happens is people have the notion that they make 8% on waiting to take Social Security. And that's true. In most cases, their check will be 8% if they wait 1 year to take Social Security, meaning if you can take it at, let's say it's 65 and you're going to get $1,000. Well, if you wait until 66, you might get an 8% higher check or $1,080. But you have to remember, by waiting that year, you've given up $12,000 in checks that you would have been receiving had you taken Social Security at 65. So to try to figure out what that difference is, what the actual difference to account for the lost check is, I've seen several different studies, and they're all over the place, but it usually is in the low to mid single digits, like that 3 to maybe 5% range. It depends really on what you do, what investments you make, and how those investments perform with money that that you take with the Social Security early. So it's still a good deal. Now, this said, Ed, you have to generally live to 80 to make waiting to take Social Security make sense. So that's almost when I run these hypothetical estimations all the time for people to say, when is it going to be the best time to take Social Security? And the lines almost always cross right around 80. So you have to live to be at least 80 to make waiting make sense. And we're going to cover that in a couple weeks on more Social Security strategies as part of our tribute to Joy Cardine and her looming retirement.
Hey, Ed, I have a question for you. Did you say, saying the words false praise, do you think that was issuing false praise?
It's like declaring bankruptcy.
One other quick question. On this Social Security, it goes from year to year. It's not prorated if you're 68 and a half or something like that?
Yeah, there's some ways that you can claim that you can get some back months if you do that. If you go to ssa.gov, they have information on how the calendar can affect your claiming. You usually get what you have coming one way or the other. You just have to make sure you get all of what you have coming.
Thanks, Ed, for the call. Let's go to Susan in Baraboo now. Hi, Susan.
Hi. I have a question about Ed Vest versus Tomorrow Scholar. My daughter has a college fund for her daughter, and it was through Ed Vest, through a financial investor. And then he changed it to Tomorrow Scholar. And I remember once you were talking to someone about not changing it to Tomorrow Scholar, but I didn't hear the response. So is there one better than the other?
Well, it depends on, you know, one of them is sold by advisors and has, I believe, I haven't used the Tomorrow Scholar at all, so I'm not familiar with what their latest iteration of it is. But sometimes I've heard stories in the past where advisors have recommended the Tomorrow Scholar because they actually earn a commission for it versus what they would get paid on the Edvest account, or maybe it's more. What I would have her do is just ask the advisor, why did you do this? What's the difference for it? And the advisor, if the commission is more, the advisor should say that. And then your daughter can decide if paying the higher commission for the advisor's services is worth it. And if she thinks it is, it is. And if it's not, it's not.
Well, once it's invested in either one, what does the advisor, does he handle it then? Does he change investments? No, that's out of his hands, isn't it?
No, he can change investments. He should consult, obviously, with their daughter if he's going to do that. But some of the investment portfolios are what are known as age-based portfolios, meaning they start out more aggressive when the beneficiary, usually the child, is younger. And then as the child grows older, the fund grows more conservative because you're more likely to be using it in the coming years. And so if it's just an age-based portfolio, no, he probably wouldn't be making changes on it. But there's still issues, you know, with handling the distribution of it. When do you take the checks? Should we tap the Edvest or the Tomorrow Scholar now versus getting a loan or using other sources or what have you? So, again, he's not getting rich off the commissions for any of these types of accounts, I'm guessing. But she should be aware of why he did it and then decide if it's worth it to stay with him.
I see. Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you, Susan. And Robert in Green Bay is with us now. Hello, Robert.
Hello.
Yes, what's your question?
My question is a little bit interesting. Just to give you a little background, I have a family of four. I'm 30 years old. I have a 401k. It's been set up about 5 years now. I got about 10% going into it. But my student loans right now are so high that if we were to make the minimum payment, we would be left with little to put into our savings account and you know, a little bit left over to get by. So we are on an income-based repayment plan right now, and our current idea is to go through the 25 years, let it be forgiven. We just bought a house, so we figure by that time we're going to have that house paid off, and then we'd use a home equity line of credit or refinance the house and then pay off the taxable income that we're going to be charged when those loans are forgiven. And my question is it better to throw everything that we have in the beginning and not really be left with much, or to assume the taxable income forgiven later on and just tack that onto the house and have another 5-10 years to pay off on the house?
Well, Robert, first of all, here's some real praise for you. You've really done your homework on this, so good for you. Now, here's the real bad news. 25 years is a very long time, and I'd love to tell you that this 25 years will be linear for you and your family of four. It's not going to be. And so while you certainly should be planning for the very long term, trying to guess what the situation is going to be for both you and the world in 25 years is very difficult. And so what I would prefer that you do is stay on the income-based repayment plan. You know, have you figured out what the balance will be, Robert, assuming everything stays the same for 25 years? How much would actually be forgiven?
If we were to stay the same right now, the amount that would be forgiven would be about $160,000.
Wow, that's that's a lot of money.
Yeah, assuming that I continue to grow on my income as well as my wife later on. Currently, mm-hmm. She's in college and she's a stay-at-home mother. But assuming that she was to work, graduate, and everything like that, we assume that we would be paying in taxable income. What they would tax us would be about $80,000.
Yeah, I don't think it would be that high. And again, it depends on your situation and the laws at that time, 25 years from now. Are you still going to be able to do this, Robert, and still contribute to your pre-tax retirement plan like you've been doing?
If I was to stay on what we're doing right now, I can continue with putting in what we're putting into the 401k with what we're putting into her Roth IRA without a problem. And okay. We also end up later on in life, I'm assuming, because we'd start working more and the kids would, you know, leave the house and we wouldn't have them as dependents, that we'd end up starting to pay, you know, a considerable amount more than we're paying right now on the income-based repayment.
Right.
So it's very possible it won't be that high, but assuming it would stay the same right now, you know, it would be considerably high.
Okay. Well, if everything, we're making a lot of assumptions here, but that's really all we can do. So, yes, I'd say to you, is it a good idea? You know, your other alternatives are to pay a ton towards the student loans, but again, you're not going to have much left over for that. And if your income does rise, so does the payment you'll make on those loans, which will help retire some of the debt, which will then make the tax portion of that. One way or the other, you're going to end up winning because, you know, even if the tax portion of the loans forgiven is, let's say, $40,000 or $50,000, you've still gotten out from under paying $100,000+ in principal, and that's a pretty good deal. I'd continue doing what you're doing, and it's a looming issue, but it's a long way away. I would just have it in mind and know that it's sooner or later you're going to owe this if indeed everything does play out, and then you can decide if you want to tap your 401ks, get a new loan. There are deals you can make with the IRS for installment plans for paying tax liabilities if you settle it up in advance with them. So no, I think you're just fine doing what you're doing, given the assumptions that we can make now.
Thanks, Robert, for the call. Good luck to you. Got a break. This is On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine, along with Kevin McKinley, financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. Here in my car, I feel safest of all. Most car owners have decided at some time or another that if they want to purchase an extended warranty on their vehicles, they've been presented with that particular choice. Kevin is going to explain whether or not it makes sense to do that. So, Kevin, how do these extended warranties work?
Well, ostensibly, they cover all repairs to the car above and beyond any manufacturer's warranty. You can purchase it on a new vehicle or a used vehicle. You can get a warranty from the manufacturer of the vehicle or a third party, and you can get an extended warranty at the time of the purchase of the vehicle or at just about any point down the road, other than when you're just sitting in the mechanic shop waiting for a $3,000 bill.
Generally, are extended warranties a good deal?
Well, like all insurance, they provide peace of mind. And a survey I saw from Career Builder last week saw that 78% of Americans who responded to the survey live paycheck to paycheck, and so they don't have the money on hand to pay for extended repairs to their vehicle. And generally, they need that vehicle to get to work, get around, get the kids, go to the grocery store, etc. But a 2013 survey from Consumer Reports of people who had purchased extended warranties for their vehicles, 55% of the respondents said they had never actually used the extended warranty, and even those who had, the median cost of the warranty was $1,200. The median dollar amount of the coverage provided, and this was just of the people who had used the warranty, was $837. So there was technically, those people lost $363 versus what they paid for the extended warranty versus what the coverage that was provided. And they found that extended warranties had one of the lowest satisfaction rates of all the products and services Consumer Reports has ever looked at, although they did find there was a little more satisfaction with people who bought less reliable vehicles. Ones who were more likely to break down obviously were happier that they had the extended warranty.
Yeah. So assuming one wants to lose $400, no, I'm just kidding. what do you do to get an extended warranty? How do you go about it?
Yeah, probably the best time to buy it is at the dealership and from the automaker, not the third party. If you are going to get one, get bumper-to-bumper to coverage. The Consumer Reports study said that those who bought the bumper-to-bumper coverage had higher satisfaction. Definitely read the fine print so you know what is covered, what's not, what terms under which it will be covered. You know, do you, Does the work have to be done at a certain shop, or does it, it can be done anywhere? And then how are the bills submitted, et cetera? And you might want to do this when you purchase the vehicle if you're tight on money and you are getting a loan to purchase the vehicle, because then you can add the extended warranty onto the price of the vehicle and roll it into the loan. And with interest rates so low, it's not very very expensive to pay it out on a kind of a month-to-month basis or so. One thing, if you are going to go through with the extended warranty, make sure you use it as a point of negotiation, because there's a ton of profit in these as a percentage of the cost. And the Consumer Report respondents said if they negotiated, they saved about $325 on average over the listing price of the extended warranty. Then also watch out for secondary offers. Sometimes if you've had a vehicle for a while and it's just coming off the manufacturer's warranty, that's in a database. And people selling you third-party warranties will try to look like they're offering this directly from the manufacturer. They're not, for better or for worse. And so make sure that you know what you're getting into when you start getting these offers.
Any advice for those who don't want to buy one?
Right. Just get a new car. You might be better off getting a brand new car, and if you can afford it, especially one from a reliable manufacturer that has a good warranty coverage on it. And then if you really want to have some extra money to pay for repairs, start setting aside the cost of the warranty at the purchase. If it's $1,200 or so, just put that in a separate bank account and say, that's my car repair fund, and it's not going to make any money, but it's not going to lose any. And if you have an emergency need for repairs, you can tap that instead and know that it's really going to go towards the repairs. But if not, it's not lost money. Or you might even want to save monthly, put aside, say, $25 a month or something like that, so that you've got an account that's building up, and you can not only have the money to pay for the repairs, but you also it feels better to say, oh, shoot, I have a repair. Well, that's what this account's for. That's what I'm going to use it for.
And we will spend the rest of the program answering your personal finance questions. We'll also have the website of the week at the end of the hour, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Mary in Madison is with us. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Oh, Joy, welcome. And good luck on your retirement. I'm so going to miss listening to you. You're just a wonderful person.
You're so sweet. Thank you, Mary.
And nothing false about that praise. Yeah.
And hello, Kevin. I love hearing all your advice. It's helped me so much. My question is, I'm going to be buying a new car that's going to be around $35,000, and would it be better to go with a car loan with no APR for 5 years versus getting a car loan with an APR for 3 years?
Oh, I'd much rather have you get the no-interest loan for 5 years. Not only does that allow you a lower payment, but you can probably pay it off early whenever you want. And because it has a lower loan payment, it'll not only save you money and provide you more flexibility, it will actually help your credit score, because a smaller portion of your income is going to pay debt off and to cover debt service. And so your credit score will be boosted as well. One thing you may want to check with the dealership is to say, if I get a 0% interest rate on the loan, do I have the option of getting cash back and getting the financing someplace else?
Oh, okay. Great.
All right. Thanks, Mary, very much for the call. And just for listeners who just heard Mary talk about my retirement, let me just put people's minds at ease that On Your Money will continue after my retirement.
What do you mean, minds at ease? They're like, oh, I thought that was the one silver lining in Joy's retirement.
Right. Oh,
we can't possibly do that show again.
Yeah. Kate Archer-Kent will be on an interim basis, filling in on the show as a permanent hiring decision is made for a new host. And Kevin has agreed to continue On Your Money for the foreseeable future. So we're happy.
Well, let's just say, you say permanent hiring. We're all temporary, Joy.
That's true. We all are. Joe in La Crosse is with us. Hi, Joe.
Hi. Good morning, both of you. So just really, really brief background. I work for the state, and so I have a retirement through them, but also contribute to a Roth and TIA CREF. Portion of my salary. And a number of years ago, I was gifted about $10,000 that we've had sitting in CDs, because we didn't know what to do with it, and we set it in CDs. And it just seems to me that there's this is money that I don't even pay attention to, that I pretend I don't have, but it seems to me that there's a much better place for it to be where it could be actually growing and maybe making some money for me. And I feel really, really anxious about who do you turn to for this? Because I'm a pretty smart person, but when it comes to these kind of things, I feel really, really ignorant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, actually, your paranoia shows a certain level of intelligence,
right.
Joe. So no, I'm perfectly fine with that. There are a lot of good places to handle it, to look for someone to invest it. I would ask friends and family and coworkers and see if they have someone who, you know, is willing to invest that amount for you. And then when you interview these people, say, what are you going to do with this money? How much is it going to cost me? What can I expect, not from the investment, but from you, if you're charging me to invest this? What kind of service do you provide? And then you really do have to kind of do some due diligence on your own part, see what the investment recommendation does actually cost. According, you know, there's been no better time like now than now to look at information online, and then kind of go with your gut for it. I wouldn't go crazy with it, especially if it feels like it's a significant amount of money for you. I wouldn't worry about trying to make extra money on it. If it's something where it would cause you heartache if you lost, say, $2,000 or $3,000 of the $10,000, I wouldn't invest in something that has risk and reward to it. You already have that with, you know, your retirement plans at work. I just put it in something like a CD that's only going to pay you 1 or 2%, but at least it's safe. It's very simple. There are no extra costs to it, and you know where the money is at all times, and you can get it if you need it.
Thanks, Joe, for the call. Jen in Waukesha is with us now. Hi, Jen.
Hi there. I have a question about a home sale. I'm wondering if we sell our home when we haven't owned it for, you know, we've actually owned our home for 2 years, and I'm wondering about capital gains tax if we do sell it, if we've lived in it for less than 5 years.
Yeah, it's if it's been in your primary residence for 2 out of the last 5 years, you generally owe no capital gains taxes on it. The exempt amount is usually $250,000 for a single person or $500,000 for a married couple filing jointly. And if you've only owned a home for 2 years and you've made $500,000 on it, congratulations. I hope you are paying capital gains taxes on it, but I highly doubt you will.
Yeah, Jen, thanks for the call. So time for website of the week, Kevin.
Yeah, this one's is very relevant, but kind of different from the normal ones that we usually offer. Al Sickerman was a writer for the Star Tribune, and he wrote kind of humorous columns about food and eating and recipes and products and everything like that. And I grew up reading him. And for better or for worse, if you don't like this show's particular tone or brand of humor, he's the one to blame because it influenced me a lot. And he passed away recently. And a couple days ago, actually. But one of the things he's remembered for is his son Joe was 18 years old in November of 1989 and was on LSD, and he fell from his 7th-floor dorm room at the University of Wisconsin and passed away. Oh. And Al wrote just a heartbreaking column, but it's one of the most touching, moving things I've ever read in my life. And he ended it with the phrase, hug your kids. And it's a good column to read if you are a parent, if you have young kids, old kids. But I even sent this to my daughter, who is going off to college this fall, and just as a notion to be careful. And because of Al's influence on me and the show, and because a lot of people have kids going off to college right now, I think it's a good thing to read. So we'll put a link up to it at the website. But it's an absolutely wonderful, heart-wrenching column to read, but it's very touching.
Yeah, I'm going to read it myself, too, and I'm sorry for your loss, Kevin. Four more words before we go.
Spend less and have more.
Thanks for joining us. Kevin McKinley, financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC. On Your Money is heard live on Tuesday mornings from 8 until 9, and we rebroadcast it Saturdays at noon. This hour was produced by Bill Martins. Michelle Johnson is our executive producer. I'm Joy Cardine, along with financial planner Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network.